her PhD from the University of Chicago, then was an instructor at MIT and a faculty member at the Max Planck Institute for Mathematics in Bonn, before moving to her current position at Caltech. She's also a PI DVRC, so she's, are you here for a while now or just for a week? And anyway, we're pleased to have her here today. She's going to talk about motives in quantum field theory.
Okay, thanks a lot for the invitation to speak in this colloquium. And I'm to say that I'm also going to be giving two more talks tomorrow and the day after tomorrow in the Geometry and Physics Conference that's ongoing. And in some sense, this talk is of course independent of the other ones, but I mean in some sense also a kind of introduction to the other talks that I'll be giving, which sort of follow other aspects of this same theme that I'm talking about today. And so, okay, there are two things in the title of my talk, there's motives and there's quantum field theory. And depending on what your background is, one of them is very mysterious, at least one of them. So one thing that I'm going to say is that I'm going to be very hand-waving about what motives are. So by the way, this is a topic on which there are a lot of kind of more technical aspects. So there's going to be a lot more details written on my slides than what I'm actually going to flesh out in the talk. Don't worry about that. I mean, I just put those in there so that the slides are available and you can think about it more if needed. But so as I said, I'm going to be rather hand-waving about what motives are, but what you should know about them is that, well, first of all, it's a very interesting and very beautiful subject of contemporary mathematics, very interesting development in algebraic geometry, number theory, and arithmetic geometry. That actually was completely envisioned and designed starting in the early 60s by Grothendieck. And the idea behind the theory of motives is that, one way you can think of what a motive is a fancy word for cohomology. And the reason behind the going from cohomology to motives is that if you deal with a special kind of spaces, which are algebraic varieties, those are spaces that are defined by solutions of polynomial equations. And of course, depending on what kind of solutions, like solutions over the complex numbers, solution over another field, a finite field or something, you get different kind of varieties, but they're all sort of basically spaces of solutions of polynomial equations. And for these kind of spaces, there are several different ways in which one can define cohomology. The most familiar kind of cohomology you'll learn about is differential forms and the Ramm cohomology. Of course, there's also cohomology in the sense of the dual of simplicial homology if you're in a topological space. And a priori, it's not immediately obvious that these two ways of defining cohomology would be the same thing. And in the case of algebraic varieties, there are several other ways of defining cohomology. And in a sense, the motives are a kind of universal cohomology theory for algebraic varieties that specializes to all the possible reasonable ways of defining cohomology for an algebraic variety, and it explains why these things have features, have isomorphism relating them, and the features in common, and what really comes from something that lies behind all of these realization of the motives in different kinds of cohomology. And this is the way that Grothendieck thought about motives. This somehow, when you come down to what that actually means, it means making the category of varieties into a nicer category. I mean, of course, modern mathematics is mostly about thinking in terms of what kind of structures the objects you're dealing with have. And often structures are formulated in the language of categories. So you have certain objects and certain morphism between them, and that what you're dealing with is that kind of structure. And ordinarily, you would think that, you have certain kind of spaces, varieties, and then the natural maps between them would be functions between these spaces, so morphism of algebraic varieties. And that's okay, but it's not so good because as a category, it doesn't have very nice properties. And so what does it mean for a category to have nice properties? Well, vector spaces is what you should have in mind. The category of vector spaces is just as good as it gets. And so when you construct another category, well, for other kind of objects, you want to make it look as much as possible like a category of vector spaces. And if you think of functions between varieties, or just think about functions between manifolds, if you or topological spaces or something, these don't much behave like functions between vector spaces, because functions between vector spaces are nice. There's a nice linear structure, so you can add them. You can do operations with them, which you cannot do with functions between spaces, between varieties. So that's what you do is you enrich your functions to something that behaves better. And the way to do that is to replace functions by correspondences. So what is a function? Well, a way of thinking what is a function is the graph is the same as giving the graph of the function. So a function is a certain special subset of the product of two spaces, which is the graph. And so what about just taking more general subsets of the product between two spaces, which are not necessarily graphs of functions? So what correspondences are, these are algebraic varieties, so we want everything to be algebraic, so they are algebraic subvarieties in the product. And you can restrict them by saying that, okay, codimension has to be the same as if they were functions, but then even though they're not necessarily functions. And then you have to do a bunch of other gymnastics to say, what do I mean that I compose two of these things? I know what it means that I compose two functions. I apply one and then I apply the other. What does it mean that I compose two subsets of one subset of the product of X and Y and one of the products of Y and Z? Well, I pull them all up to X times Y times Z and I intersect them there and then I push them forward to X times Z. Okay, and if takes a little moment of thinking and say that if you do that with the graphs of functions, you get back the usual composition of functions as we know it. So it's a bunch of ideas on how to make the category of varieties nicer. And turns out you have to do a little bit more that. So you wanna for reasons of having a nice duality. I mean, in vector spaces, you also have a duality. You have the dual vector space. And so you want to, again, mimic what happens in the category of vector spaces. So you want to have a nice duality. It turns out that if you want to do that, you need to be able to shift the codimension of correspondences in a nice way. And if I want to increase the codimension, if I have a subset of a something n-dimensional, if I take a product with a line, I make it n plus one dimensional, and I'm increasing the codimension of the thing I have. But if I want to decrease the codimension, I want to somehow a formal inverse of taking a product with another dimension. And that's what in the theory of motives is called inverting the Lefschetz motive. It's a way of saying that you're allowed to shift the codimension of cycles in arbitrary dimension. So if you do all of these things, you get a good category. So you have your varieties fit into a category that looks very much like the category of vector spaces. There's a very nice result of Janssen in the early 90s that pretty much tells you that it gets as close as possible as having all the nice properties of the category of vector spaces, which in the language of everything means being a semi-simple abelian category. Okay, so however, this nice story works for special kind of varieties, which are smooth projective varieties. So those are things that are smooth and compact. And of course, not all the interesting spaces in the world are smooth and compact. A lot of them are singular, non-compact, and so on. And in fact, the interesting cases we're going to be seeing soon that arise in physics all happen to be both singular and non-compact. So they happen to be outside of the nicest case, which is called the pure motives case, which is the one that behaves in the nicest possible way. So what one does to extend the theory of motives from the nice smooth projective varieties to the less nice singular and or non-compact ones is to devise another theory, which is called mixed motives, where all of these varieties are allowed. And that is a very thorny issue because You know, it's a more complicated setting. It's not known if there is a category of mixed motives that has these nice properties, if it's possible to construct one. What one has is something weaker, which is called a triangulated category. Basically, you know, it's the properties it has. Remember, you know, motives are kind of a fancy word for cohomology. So when you have a cohomology of a non-compact thing, what you have is, you know, you don't have Poincaré duality anymore, but you have things that are long exact sequences. For, you know, if you have a sub-variety inside another variety, you have. So that's where these triangulated structure come from. It mimics the properties that you want to have of a cohomology for a non-compact varieties. So there is a construction, you know, that took a long time to get to that. I mean, there are different forms of the construction of Vojvodsky, Mark Levin, and Nomura. And they turned out in the end to be equivalent of a category of mixed motives. But they're very complicated categories to deal with. There is a special case of a subcategory of this very complicated and mysterious category of mixed motives, which are called mixed state motives. And that's basically those that are built by extension, by non-trivial extensions, out of pieces that look like projective spaces. So those are kind of the nicest possible motives inside the category of mixed motives. And the point is that, however, these extensions can be very non-trivial, so also the category of mixed state motives is not so, I mean, it's much better understood than the more general category of mixed motives, but it's already a very complicated object to deal with. Okay, so what I'm going to do a little bit later in the talk is to actually say, you know, pass from this sort of a very abstract and complicated world of these categories of motives to something which is more like an Euler characteristic for motives, and which is has the advantage of telling you a lot of information about the motive, but being a much simpler object to deal with, and where one can actually compute things. Well, sometimes one can compute things in a more approachable way. So now, okay, what has all this got to do with quantum field theory? I mean, so far we are sort of up there in the world of abstract algebraic geometry. You know, when Grothendieck designed this idea of motives, he was infinitely far away from the idea of any kind of physical applications. And it's only roughly in the last 10 years that from different points of view, the connections between quantum field theories and motives started to pop up in a lot of ways. So I will follow one particular way of seeing the connection between quantum field theory and motives. Actually, I'll talk about some other ways in my other talks, and you know, other talks in the conference that's going on right now also can be seen as having to do with the relation between quantum field theory and motives in other ways. So by now it's clear, you know, with a series of results that happened in the last few years, that actually there is a very interesting connection between these two seemingly completely unrelated theories. So let me take this point of view. Let's look at just a massless scalar field theory. I'm going to make it Euclidean. And so, okay, you have a usual Lagrangian density. And we're going to treat it perturbatively. So you, take the perturbative expansion. And you have a contribution, you have an expansion in Feynman graphs of the theory, and you have a contribution for each Feynman graph. And the contribution of a Feynman graph is usually given by a finite dimensional integral over momenta. So today I'm gonna have everything in momentum space. Actually, if people are interested, there's a picture in configuration space which has to do with different kind of geometries still related to motives that I'll talk about tomorrow. But if you think in momentum space, we think of the contribution of graphs as being integrals over momenta associated to the edges of the graph. We think of a given configuration of external momenta, and you know, we have an integrand that is built out of integrating over momenta associated to each of the internal lines with conservation laws at the vertices, the usual story. And the way the form that you integrate is built is dictated by the Feynman rules of the theory. So it does tell you that each internal line contributes a quadratic form, so 1 over a quadratic form in the momentum attached to that line. So for the moment, I have a mass term in there, which will disappear promptly because I'm going to consider the massless case. And then at each vertex, you have a conservation law over the momenta, the momenta that go through that, of the edges that go through that vertex. And so you get, you know, a certain integrand where, you know, you integrate over all these momentum variables. You have the product of this quadratic form in the denominator, and you have all these linear constraints take into account. Now, these have two simple formal properties. One is that, you know, if the graphs, if you have connected components, it's just multiplicative over connected components because there's no relations between the momenta. And if you have a graph that is not one particle irreducible, so that you can disconnect by cutting an edge somewhere, then, you know, it's also kind of multiplicative, except that you also have to put in the propagator of that edge. So this is called a multiplicative decomposition, which tells you that in the end, the only interesting things you need to take care of is how these things are defined for the 1PI graphs. And this, I'll maybe say something later, you can use them formally to define things that behave like Feynman rules, but that are directly algebra geometric. But I'll come back to that later. And so, okay, let's do some of the usual, you know, exercises, elementary exercises in quantum field theory. So what one does is, you know, there's the usual trick, Schwinger parameters, Feynman trick. And so it turns out that one can rewrite the integral by replacing the product of the quadratic forms in the denominator with an integral over a simplex of a combination of the quadratic form, some power of a linear combination of the quadratic form with these coefficients or the variables in the simplex. And then, you know, when you perform the momentum variable integration, you can make a simple change of variables that reduces it to variables that correspond to the number of loops. Those are the independent variables you have, and integrate over those, and you get rid of some Gaussian integrals and so on. So this is a very standard elementary exercise in quantum field theory. But the point, so this is the Feynman parametric, the parametric form of the Feynman integral. You end up, you know, rewriting it as an integral where you have, so you have a gamma function term which gives you divergences at the poles of the gamma function. And when you sort of ignore that divergence and you focus on this integral here, you find something that now has an interesting form because you have some functions there, which I'll say something about in a second, which are actually polynomial functions. So it turns out to be an algebraic differential form, so differential form that is, you know, has polynomial, it's given by a rational function polynomial, and it's integrated over this simplex. And well, there's divergences still because, you know, that nothing prevents, and in fact it does happen, that the simplex would intersect the places where the denominator of this form vanishes. Those are the infrared divergences because you have it's a massless theory now. So these polynomials are actually combinatorial polynomials of the graph. They're the two Szymanski's polynomials. One of them is just the sum over the spanning trees of the graph and the product over the edges that are not in the spanning tree. That's the Kirchhoff polynomial of the graph. And the other one that has also includes the structure of the external momenta is also similarly defined in a combinatorial way that involves cuts in the graph. So I'm going to look at, so there's some particular cases, say I'm going to focus on the ones where, you know, the Kirchhoff polynomial is actually in the denominator, so this depends on what is the relation between the number of edges, the number of loops, and the dimension. So depending on that, you have different ranges. But there's a particularly simple case, which is the log divergence case, where the number of edges is d divided by 2 times the number of loops. And in that case, one of the terms disappears, and you just have a simpler form like that. So what this means is that, so you're trying to compute an integral like that. And obviously, the differential form that you're integrating is not defined everywhere. It's defined where the denominator doesn't vanish. The denominator is a polynomial, so it's defined on the complement of an algebraic variety. An algebraic variety is a solution of a polynomial equation. In this case, it's where that polynomial vanishes. It's given by a single equation, so it's a hypersurface. So there's a hypersurface in your space of variables where the form is not defined. Now, for physical purposes, the momentum variables are real, but it's convenient to consider that real space as being inside the complex space. So thinking of all the variables as complex, so you're inside some affine space, complex space, where there is a hypersurface, which is where that polynomial vanishes. And so the reason for passing to complex variables is just a very basic fact that algebraic geometry over the complex numbers is much easier than algebraic geometry over the real numbers, because C is an algebraically closed field. So no, there's nothing mysterious about that. It's just convenient to do that. Okay. And so you're integrating a differential form over some locus. So this is a, you can view it as a pairing of cohomology and homology, except that the place you're integrating over is not a cycle, it has a boundary, it's a simplex. Okay? So what you can do is interpret it in terms of a pairing of relative homology and cohomology, or relative cohomology and homology. So you want to look at in the end, the cohomology whose motive we are considering, you can view it as a cohomology. Well, I'm writing things in projective space rather than in affine space because the polynomial is homogeneous. So it really doesn't matter if you scale everything by the same factor. You still know the same set of solutions, so you might as well restrict to the projective case. And again, why? Because projective space is a compact space, and affine space is not, and so that's compact things are easier, so better to look at it in projective space. So you can view this, the motive you're interested in, as the one that's underlying the relative cohomology of the hypersurface complement in projective space relative to something which contains the boundary of the simplex, because we have this problem that the domain of integration has a boundary. So you can just you want something algebraic, because you want everything to be defined algebraic, otherwise this motives business won't work. So you just take a divisor and a union of hypersurface. In this case, you just take a union of hyperplane, of all the coordinate hyperplanes. The boundary of the simplex is contained on the coordinate hyperplanes. So if you do that, you have some locus that contains the boundary of the simplex. So that's the geometric setting we're looking at. That's where the integral lives, the integral that we're trying to compute. So why are we interested in writing it in this form, in thinking of it in this cohomological way? The point is that this, everybody knows by looking at quantum field theory, computing these Feynman integrals is hard. It's really hard even for simple graphs. And you want to know something about what kind of numbers you're going to get out of these Feynman integrals without computing them. That's something where this motivic point of view comes in, because there are some classes of numbers that are called periods. These in general are numbers that need not be algebraic, so they need not be solutions of polynomial equations. So they could be transcendental numbers, but they are somehow obtained by some algebraic procedure. What I mean by that is that they are obtained by integrating an algebraic differential form over some locus that's defined by algebraic equations. So the number that you get need not be algebraic, but the procedure that produces the number is all defined in terms of algebraic things and the pairing of homology and cohomology. And the interesting fact about periods is that there's a relation between periods and motives in the sense that what kind of motive, what kind of subcategory of this big category of motives your variety happens to be contained in, determines what kind of numbers you can obtain as periods. You have an arbitrary choice of numbers that you can get, but they are constrained. And so, you know, if you can, the idea is that if you can say something about the motive, you can say a lot about what kind of numbers you can get out of these integrals, even if you're not able to actually compute the integrals. And the point is that if you already know that a number is of a certain kind, it might actually be, you know, computationally easier to get what the number should be, even that. No, so let me be a bit more precise on that in a moment. But let me just mention a couple of facts. There's a couple of things that I swept under the rug. One major thing that I swept under the rug is the fact that I mentioned before that these integrals are divergent because the locus where you're integrating actually touches the zeros of the hypersurface in the denominator. So you have to do something about these divergences, otherwise it doesn't. So the point, if the integral were convergent, then it would be a period of this complement of the hypersurface, so on, because it would be manifestly an integral of an algebraic differential form over something that's defined by algebraic equation. But if it's divergent, it doesn't make sense to say that it's a period. So you have to do something to get rid of the divergences. I'll only mention the fact that one can do that, so there's some work of Block and Kramer that dealt with that in terms of doing blow-ups that, you know, separate the locus of divergence from the locus of integration. In a proper sense, there's some ambiguities one has to take care of that depend on monodromies. So there's a longer, very interesting story behind this, but I'm just going to, you know, mention that, okay, one has to deal with that problem before really interpreting them as periods. But, okay, let's assume that for the moment, again, let me put it back under the rug and come back to pretend that the problem is not there. So there's one particular class of numbers that are interesting and that arise as periods. These are called the multiple zeta values. And, well, they're called multiple zeta values because if you only have one of the terms in the sum, one of the n to the k, it would be a value of the Riemann zeta function at an integer. So these are generalizations of special values of the Riemann zeta function where you have a sum over a sequence of integers. And these have a lot of interesting number theoretic properties that have been studied a lot. And the interesting fact is that they are actually, so to be more precise, linear combination of multiple zeta values with coefficients that are either rational numbers or powers of 2 pi I are exactly the numbers that can arise as periods of motives that are in the special mixed state subcategory of the category of mixed motives. So one direction was known. There were several constructions. There was a very nice construction by Goncharov and Manin that realizes the multiple zeta values as periods of moduli spaces of curves, of rational curves, which are mixed state motives. For higher genus curves, they're not. But so one direction was known. The other was conjecture. So the fact that these are periods, that's the fact that one can see by direct constructions. The fact that these are exactly all the periods that can arise from mixed state motives was conjectured for a long time. It was proved recently by Francis Brown a few years ago. And the reason, so in a sense, the multiple zeta values are one of the origins of this whole story about the interaction between quantum field theory and motives, because in explicit calculation, numerical calculations of Feynman integrals, one keeps running into multiple zeta values. So it was a huge database of computations that was put together in the 90s, and Broadhurst and Kramer were the first who wrote this kind of analysis that, you know, showed the multiple zeta values are pervasively present in this Feynman integral calculation. And of course, if you have in mind this sort of point of view, if you see multiple zeta values everywhere, you think there has to be, you know, that kind of motives, state motives, have to be behind the scene. because that those are the things that produce multiple zeta values. So there has to be a reason why this class of numbers is so pervasive. So this thing led in the late 90s Concevich to conjecture that these graph hypersurfaces, so these loci of vanishing of these polynomials that arise in the Feynman integral that I just showed, in the parametric Feynman integral that I showed before, would always be mixed state motifs, because that would explain why you would always see multiple zeta values. And so this, okay, you know, sounded like a kind of convincing evidence. Unfortunately, the conjecture is false. And so there's a very nice, this actually was found out not long after it was initially formulated. There's a beautiful paper by Berkal and Brosnan that give a very absurd general argument that shows why the conjecture is false, in the sense that it shows that the motifs of these graph hypersurfaces can become arbitrarily complicated as motifs as the graph grows in size. And so at some point they will escape this mixed state subcategory. And so, however, that's a kind of abstract argument. It uses some universality theorem for representations of matroids, and so it doesn't tell you, you know, hands-on, here's an example of something that does not produce a multiple zeta value or something that is not. So, but I mean, it just shows that you cannot expect these things to be always mixed state motives. But, you know, in principle, this would not prevent the Feynman integrals to always come out as combinations of multiple zeta values, because it could be that, you know, you're computing one particular period, not computing all the periods of this variety, you're computing one particular period, which is the Feynman amplitude, one that comes from the Feynman amplitude. And it could be that that particular period, for some reason, always happens to be supported on a particular locus in the variety. And even if the variety gets very complicated elsewhere, that particular part might remain in the mixed state. So in a sense, this result of Berkal and Brosnan kills this general conjecture of Concevich, but it doesn't kill the question of whether, you know, the Feynman amplitude itself would always be a period of a mixed state motive. However, you know, there are some much more specific examples that have been constructed in the last few years by Dimitri Doring, Francis Brown, and Oliver Schnetz, where they actually do come up with more explicit cases. You have to go to fairly large graphs, but so something that has 12 edges and 9 loops, and you know, it's but so they're not very physically, you know, meaningful graphs. And you don't normally get to you know, 9 loops, but I mean the point is that if you go far enough in the asymptotic expansion, you're going to meet things that are not mixed state, and they're seriously not mixed state. Not just that the old variety is not, but the actual part that supports the period is not. And so, in a sense, this leaves open a lot of questions, because you want to know when this happens, what kind of other periods come up, are there certain particular families of graph where you always stay within the mixed state part? So what is the picture? What is going on? Okay, so you know, I'm going to try to, you know, give some examples and some cases where you can say something and so on. So to do that, as I said, I'm going to make a simplification. Instead of talking about the motives and these categories, these triangulated categories of mixed state motives, which are, you know, as I said, very difficult to deal with, I'm going to make a simplification and pass from motives to classes in the growth and decaying of varieties. And in a sense, the way you should think, the growth and decaying of varieties is simply defined. So you have algebraic varieties over some field, and you look at equivalence classes of up to isomorphism of algebraic varieties. So you look at varieties up to isomorphism. And then so those are the generators. And you introduce a relation that is basically an inclusion-exclusion relation. So if you have a subvariety, a closed subvariety that's embedded in your variety, so y is embedded in x, then the class of x has to be the sum of the class of y and the class of the complement. And the other thing is you give it, so up to this, it's an abelian group, and when this generator, you give it a ring structure by, you know, defining the product of two classes as the class of the Cartesian product of the varieties. So it's a ring, and inside this ring, there's a very simple polynomial subring, which is generated by the Lefschetz motif, which is the class of a line. So everything that's just polynomial in the line. And that's the in this formulation, those are the Tate motifs. And so in this setting, you know, the question becomes, you know, if you have a variety and you compute the class in the Grothendieck ring, can you write it as a polynomial with integer coefficients in the class of the affine line? And that, you know, it's a simpler way of asking the question of whether a motif is mixed state or not. The reason why I'm saying that you should think of this class in the Grothendieck ring as a kind of Euler characteristic is because, you see, these two relations, the inclusion-exclusion relation and the product relation, are exactly the kind of formal properties that the Euler characteristic has. And, you know, the Euler characteristic is additive on, splitting things, and it's multiplicative on products. And in fact, you know, in the Grothendieck ring is kind of like the universal Euler characteristic for algebraic varieties. Like, in a sense, no motives are like the universal cohomology theory for algebraic varieties, and this is like the universal Euler characteristic for algebraic varieties. In the sense that if you have any ring of, if you have any invariant of algebraic varieties that is satisfies inclusion exclusion and is multiplicative on products, and it has to factor through the Grothendieck ring. So the ordinary Euler characteristic, the counting of the number of points over finite fields is another example. There are more sophisticated examples that come from the theory of motives. There's a motivic Euler characteristic and so on. So there are examples, but I mean, in a sense, we are simplifying the picture by sort of looking at Euler characteristics instead of looking at homology. So there's an interesting, let me just mention this thing, though, that the result of Belkal and Brosnan is formulated in terms of classes in the Grothendieck ring. And it shows that the classes of the graph hypersurfaces of Feynman graphs actually, in a suitable sense, span the Grothendieck ring. That's what I meant by saying that the motifs get arbitrarily complicated. What I mean, they span a localization of the Grothendieck ring at these localized at the multiplicative system related by L to the n minus L. By the way, there's an interesting fact there. That localization of the Grothendieck ring of varieties is itself a Grothendieck ring of another kind of interesting algebra-geometric objects, which are stacks. Stacks are kind of like quotients of varieties by groups. But and there's no a priori reason why stacks should appear in this picture, because, you know, in the picture with the quantum field theory. But the result of Helmbrosnan says that the classes, the Grothendieck ring that they span is really the one of stacks. So that's a question out there. I mean, is there something deeper behind this fact, or is it just a coincidence? There's an interesting thing that, you know, if you do the opposite, so in doing this localization, in particular, you're inverting the Lefschetz motif, exactly as you do whenever you build the category of motives. So that's okay from the motivic point of view. If you do the opposite thing, you formally put L equal to zero, so you kill the Lefschetz motif. Then, you know, what you get is another group that's interesting from the algebra geometric perspective, is the stable birational equivalence classes of varieties. And the thing is that the graph hypersurfaces of quantum field theory, they all become trivial in the stable birational equivalence sense. But they are as large as possible when you invert L. So again, this is another fact that, okay, you show it's like that, but it's not completely clear what it means. But let me just give an example, just to show something that one can compute in a rather simple way. So let's take a very simple kind of graph, which is I'm going to call them the banana graph. So it has two vertices and a bunch of parallel edges between them. You can forget the external edges because those are only in the other polynomial, not the one that defines the upper surface. So. So in this case, the class in the Grothendieck ring is actually a polynomial. Well, there's a denominator, but the denominator cancels. So it's really a polynomial in the Lefschetz motif. In this case, the reason why this is computable in a simple way is because there's an accident for this graph, which is kind of nice, which is that if you look at, it's a planar graph, and if you look at the dual graph, it's just a polygon. So the dual graph is much simpler in the sense of the topology of the graph. And for a polygon, the graph polynomial is simply a linear combination of variables, so it's the graph hypersurface is a hyperplane. And the thing is that if a graph is planar, there is a nice relation between the graph hypersurface of the graph and the one of the dual graph. So they are related by a transformation which is very famous in algebraic geometry. It's called the Cremona transformation. So you can think of it in the following way. Suppose you have the plane and you look at the simplex, the algebra geometric simplex, so the union of the coordinate lines in the plane, and you blow up the points, the vertices, and you get something like the hexagon there, so each vertex becomes a line, and then you blow up the other lines, you blow down the other lines, and you get another simplex. So that's a way of thinking of what the Cremona transformation does. More explicitly, what it does, it inverts each of the coordinates, but so since you are in projective space, it's defined outside of the union of the coordinate hyperplanes. So the polynomials have this nice relation under this transformation, namely that the graph polynomial of a planar graph is the same as the graph polynomial of the dual graph composed with this Cremona transformation times the defining equation for the simplex of coordinate hyperplanes, which is where the transformation is not defined. So it means that, because outside of these locus of the coordinate hyperplanes, the Cremona transformation is an isomorphism, so the class in the Grothendieck ring of the parts in this complement have to be the same. They are defined up to isomorphism, so they have to be the same class. So what you can do, if you have a situation where a planar graph, but one of the two sides, you have the planar graph and the dual graph, you have the situation where one of the two sides is easier to deal with. What you do is, the classes in the Grothendieck ring will be the same outside of the union of coordinate hyperplanes. So you have to only find out what happens, how they intersect the union of coordinate hyperplanes and compute that part. And then you get a computation of the class. And so if you apply it to this example, the banana graph, you find that the way that the graph hypersurface intersects the union of the coordinate hyperplanes is along the intersections of the hyperplanes, so along the codimension 2 piece, where the locus of singularities of the union of the coordinate hyperplanes, where at least two of the hyperplanes intersect. And that's simple, that has a very simple class to compute. And it's just the class of the whole union of the coordinate hyperplanes minus the torus, that's the open part. And so you can put together the two pieces and that gives you the class. So, okay, this is fine. I mean, it's an example where you can see how something computed, but it's obvious that you cannot generalize this thing because, it's not going to, it's a lucky situation where you can do this. So in general, you cannot do the same. And so that shows that even though you simplify the situation by going from motives to classes in the growth and decaying, the computation are still going to get fairly complicated as soon as the graph gets, you know, a little bit more complicated. So let me, so I have a few topics that I might, let me mention one thing that's also quite interesting. So the individual, as you've seen, if you look at an individual graph, we know that, you know, by these results of Belkal and Brosnan and so on, that if the graph gets sufficiently large and sufficiently complicated, you're gonna at some point find classes that are outside of the mixed state part of the growth and decaying. However, there's a very nice observation by Spencer Block a few years ago that if you sum together graphs, so what he means by that is you fix the number of vertices and you look at all graphs, so all graphs that don't have looping edges or parallel edges. So basically those are graphs that you can obtain from the complete graph by removing a certain number of edges. And so you look at all those graphs that have the same number of vertices and you sum the classes weighted by dividing by the appropriate factor as you do in the usual Feynman integral expansion that takes into account the symmetries of the graph. Then you get a certain element in the growth and decaying, which is a sum of classes of graphs. So the statement is that element is always in the mixed state part, even when the individual graphs start to get large enough that they will not be anymore. So it means there's a lot of cancellations that happen in the sum that somehow, you know, kill the non-mixed state part. And so this is sort of suggestive because, you know, when you do the asymptotic expansion in quantum field theory, clear that in a sense it's not the individual Feynman graph that matters. I mean, the physical process is not an individual Feynman graph, but it's a sum over graphs. Normally it's a sum over graph with a fixed number of loops rather than with a fixed number of vertices. But I mean, this is sort of reminiscent of the fact that, you know, it should really be a combination of graphs that matters. Unfortunately, you know, periods don't factor through the growth and decaying, so you cannot just say, you know, if I combine the graphs, then the periods are going. So, you know, it's not. So what I'm saying is just that this result itself does not, you know, tell you more about the original question of whether the periods, I mean, the Feynman integrals viewed as periods would be periods of mixed state motives or not, but it does suggest strongly that, you know, in some way combining the amplitudes of families of graphs with a fixed structure, either fixed number of vertices or fixed number of loops, so on, would be, you know, might help the approach. Let me actually first go to one thing that I want to tell you about. Yeah, and I skipped a bunch of things that I might get back to or not. It doesn't matter. But let me say something about what you can try to do, given that, you know, you have this difficulties computing the classes in the growth and decaying. So, you know, the polynomial that defines the hypersurface, the graph polynomial, the Kirchhoff polynomial graph, has one very nice property, which is that it satisfies deletion contraction. So what that means is that the polynomial of a graph has a simple expression in terms of the polynomial of the graph where you remove an edge and the polynomial of the graph when you contract an edge. So this actually gives a way of computing the polynomial, you know, when you increase the complexity of graphs just by, you know, undoing it, by reducing it to simpler graphs, repeatedly applying the deletion-contraction relation. And actually the two pieces, the deletion and the contraction, have a simple relation to the polynomial of the graph. So deleting an edge is like taking a derivative of the polynomial with respect to that variable, and contracting an edge is like setting one of the variables equal to zero. And so, okay, you can't quite expect that this deletion contraction at the level of the polynomial will translate into something like a deletion contraction at the level of the classes in the Grothendieck ring, just because, well, that wouldn't work, because if you had a deletion contraction, you know, on the nose, as in the case of the polynomial, then your class would always be mixed state, because you know it is for sufficiently small graphs, and if you can just, by a simple formula, reduce to the smaller graph by a combination of things, it would always, so you know that you will not be able to find something like that. But you can try to see how close you can get to having a deletion contraction at the level of the Grothendieck classes using the fact that you have a deletion contraction for the polynomial. And so one can actually formulate this. This is, you know, in this paper we did a few years ago with Paolo Luffy. And you know, you can actually formulate it quite generally for polynomials that have a similar relation like this deletion contraction formula. And the property that matters in the graph polynomial is the fact that each variable appears either of degree one if it appears, or it doesn't appear at all. That's the important thing. So the result is that the best you can get is something that at first looks a bit like a deletion contraction. So you look at it's natural to formulate it in terms of the classes of the complement of the hypersurface. After all, no, the complement of the hypersurface is really where the period lives. So let's write things in terms of the complement. So if you look at the complement, and I'm writing it in affine space, there's a similar formula in projective space, it's just slightly more complicated, so let me just write it in affine space. So the class of the complement of a graph hypersurface is a combination of with one coefficient is the line, the Lefschetz motif, and the other is just a constant. And so on one side you have the complement of the deletion, so the complement of the hypersurface of the graph where you deleted an edge. That's fine. But the other terms is not the complement of the contraction, is something more complicated, is the complement of the intersection between the deletion and the contraction. So that's where the problem is, because you can make even fairly simple examples of this sort. So you can have two varieties that are perfectly nice mixed state motifs, but whose intersection is not. They intersect in a locus which is not mixed state. I mean, you can realize an elliptic curve as a hyperplane section and some. So it's fairly easy to construct examples like that. So the point is that the point of that formula is that even if you can separately control the motives of the deletion and the contraction, it doesn't necessarily control the class of the complement of the larger graph, because you don't know how these two pieces intersect. They could be intersecting in something very complicated. But so you can say, okay, then it's not so useful, because you have this term that is difficult to control. But what you can look for are families of graphs for which you can kind of do a sort of inductive argument on how you build them, how you increase the size of the graph in a controlled way, so that you get rid of these complicated term, or you can control this complicated term. So let me give a simple example of what I'm talking about. So a simple example is the process. So you start with a graph, you pick one of the edges of the graph, and you start adding parallel edges to that. That's a sort of stupid operation to do, but it's one example of a family of graphs that you can get by iterating a simple operation starting from a given graph, for which you will never exit the mixed state class. So if you start with one, you will stay in the same class. So the point with that is that if you look at what happens when you just do the first step, you double an edge, and you look at what happens to the deletion contraction, this deletion contraction relation with the intersection term in it. So it turns out that you can, you know, cancel this intersection term in this doubling formula. And you end up with a formula where the class, so this notation is just for the class of the complement, simple notation for the class of the complement. So the class of the complement for the graph with the doubled edge is just a function of the class with that you, of the graph you started with, the class where you delete an edge, and the class where you contract an edge. So the troublesome intersection term has disappeared. And then so you can bootstrap this to an inductive procedure for an arbitrary number of doubling, and you get a simple generating function that tells you that you always stay in this mixed state part. So, I mean, of course, this is a very simple example, but you know, it just shows that if you work carefully with cases where you can control this intersection, then at least you may be able to identify certain specific infinite families of graphs where you can still control the behavior of the class. So this another there are some other simple examples like that. So I mean, if you take a graph that's obtained by a wedge of triangles, you know, you have another similar inductive formula, and if you combine the two, you can get that an arbitrary chain of polygons has a class that stays in this class. So I mean, that's kind of a few simple examples where this works. Okay, what else can you do? Well, another type of approach, which I'm gonna talk about one way of approaching this, and one of my students is working on a slightly different way of approaching the same question. And so it's, the idea is this, so you have this integral that you wanna compute of this polynomial, this rational function, this differential form over the simplex. And as I said, you think of it in terms of the motive of the complement of the graph hypersurface in either projective or affine space relative to this divisor of the coordinate hyperplanes that contains the boundary of the simplex. Now, you're not obliged to think of this integral in that variety. So if you can map the same integral into some other variety by just mapping everything in a way that you don't kill any part of the integral that you want to compute, then you can view the same integral as a period of some other variety. So one of the possible other approaches to try to get around the difficulties of computing these classes would be, let's try to, it's difficult to compute the motives or the classes in the growth and decaying of the graph hypersurface complements. Well, let's forget about the graph hypersurface complement. You just try to map the whole integral to some other place where the motive is easier to control. So there's one first choice that is kind of obvious, because the graph polynomial, one way I described it is as the sum over the spanning trees of the graph and the product of variables not in the spanning tree, but it's also the determinant of a certain matrix described in terms of the combinatorics of the graph, which gives the same result. So because this polynomial is the determinant of some matrix, you can use this matrix to map from your space of affine coordinates associated to the edges of the graph to some other space where the hypersurface would just be the determinant hypersurface. So you have a map from an affine space in coordinates that correspond to the edges of the graph to an affine space in coordinates that correspond to the number of loops times the number of loops in the graph, so L squared. And the map is exactly the matrix whose determinant is the graph polynomial. Well, why is this any better? Well, the reason why it's better, or it looks better at first, We'll see that there's a universal law of conservation of difficulties, so something something is going to pop up somewhere else. But the reason why at first it looks like, okay, this is going to get much better, is because the determinant hypersurface has a motive that is simple. It's easy to compute. You can write it out explicitly. And it's mixed state. It's manifestly a polynomial in the Lefschetz motive. You can write the formula really explicitly. I mean, the complement of the determinant hypersurface is GL, so that's the motive of GL. So that's, yeah, something very well-known. And okay, so you have to, well, you still have to be careful about one thing, that you're not losing anything behind when you map the integral over to the complement of the determinant hypersurface. So you want this map to be injective. You want to not to have a kernel. But okay, that depends on some combinatorial conditions on the graph, which I'll say in a moment. But anyway, what you're doing is you're trading the question of whether the complement of the graph hypersurface relative to the divisor of coordinate hyperplanes was mixed state with a new question of whether the complement of the determinant hypersurface relative to some divisor that contains the boundary of the domain of integration is going to be mixed state. So now what happens is that in the previous case, in a sense, in this relative cohomology thing, the left-hand side was the difficult part. And the right-hand side wasn't so difficult. You just had the coordinate hyperplanes. Now what's going to happen is that the left-hand side is the nice one, because we have manifestly everything nice and mixed state. But the right-hand side is going to become tricky. And that's going to be the law of conservation of difficulties that I talked about. Well, so regarding the embedding, I mean, the fact that you don't lose anything behind in doing this, there's some combinatorial conditions on the graph that you can check. So it's not true for all graphs, but the graphs for which it's true are a slight strengthening on the usual 1PI condition, which is this two vertex connected condition with phase width at least two. So it's just a little bit stronger than 1PI. So what happens with the, as I said, I mean, there is this right-hand side of this relative motive that is the one that is going to become troublesome. And what you want is some kind of hypersurface locus variety that will contain the boundary of the domain of integration and that replaces the union of coordinate hyperplanes. But so what you want to see is some divisor, and you want the part that doesn't intersect the determinant hypersurface, because you are in the complement of the determinant hypersurface. And so the question becomes about understanding this intersection, understanding what if that intersection is mixed state. So there's a kind of in this mixed state category, one has these exact sequences or these triangles. And usually the rule is that if you want to show that something, so if you have these triangles, and if you want to show that something is in the category, in the mixed state category, if you show that two of the terms of the triangles are, then the third one also is. And so here, in a sense, you have this relative, but if you show that both pieces are in the mixed state category, then the one that you want also is. And so one of them is certainly the complement of the determinant hypersurface, and the other one is the one where things are getting complicated. So you can repackage the question in a more general sense, in terms of these certain kind of varieties of frames where you have vectors in certain directions, but with the requirement that the combination is in the complement of the determinant hypersurface. And one can compute at least for the first few terms, one can compute what these classes are, and you know, it's okay. It's, they are functions of they are polynomials in the Lefschetz motif, but they get complicated as soon as you increase, because you have all the possible ways that these loci can intersect. And again, no controlling intersections, even if you know the separate pieces, you know, are nice and all. I mean, controlling the intersections get difficult. And so in the end, it turns out that when you repackage the question in algebra, in more algebra geometric terms, it becomes a question about how certain flag varieties, certain loci in flag varieties intersect. And these questions are actually, from an algebra geometric perspective, fairly hard. Intersections of union of Schubert cells, they're related to Kasdan-Lustig theory, and it's not obvious at all that they stay mixed state. It becomes difficult to control. So there's another approach following this line, which I will not talk about, and which is to replace the place where, again, map it to the determinant, the complement of the determinant hypersurface, and then choose a suitable compactification of the complement of the determinant hypersurface, which is it's called the Kaus compactification of GLN. And these they're again loci where you can compute the motif nicely, and you try to write the integral in this pull it back to this compactification and get rid of divergences there and try to view it as a period there. So some work that I did with a student of mine recently right there. So I'm I can only maybe say, let me just say one word about this. So this is like just a sneak preview of my next talk. There's another way of trying to deal with this problem, which is instead of looking at these integrals in momentum space, look at them in configuration space, so in position space. And then, again, they become a question of certain kind of motives, which are the motives of the compactifications of configuration spaces. And that's what I will talk about in another talk tomorrow. And again, one comes up. But in all of these cases, so these are all different approaches to try to address the same question of what kind of periods and motives arise in this Feynman integral computation. So none of these approaches give complete answers, because we know that these motives are going to get fairly complicated at some point. But they give you different possible approaches, and also they give you, which I'll try to say something in my other talks, they give you different possible methods of regularizing these integrals and renormalizing them, which are different, sometimes more geometric and sometimes different from the usual methods that are used in physics. So I think I can really stop here for today. And I just wanted to give a kind of panorama of what is going on in this. There are other results in which one sees the relation between quantum field theory and motives. One which is again related to computation of amplitudes, but is in the super Young-Mills case, where one again sees functions like. So that, another aspect that I did not have time to talk about is the fact that motives also have a kind of analytic side, which is mixed Hodge structures, and functions like polylogs and multiple polylogs arise naturally from that perspective, like the multiple zeta values arise as the periods. And one sees these functions appearing in these amplitudes calculations, and which again is a sign that they are very closely related to mixed state motives, and the fact that they're written in terms of Grassmannians. Grassmannians are also nice examples of state motives, and so on. So there are a lot of other settings where one sees more and more that there is a close relation between computational Feynman integrals and aspects of the theory of periods and motives of algebraic varieties. And there's probably still a lot of stuff that will, you know, needs to be uncovered in what the actual structures behind this are, and really what kind of periods and motives one expects to find. But yeah, that's where things stand at the moment.